let me thank Geraldine and Sabine for the invitation to give this colloquium. And I'm very excited about this topic. This felt very, it's very dear to me and to all of the people are involved. So we have, at UBC, we have a very unique chance, and that is to actually, all the theories we predicted, black hole, to mimic in the lab. And I'm talking about black holes here. We want to see traces, a classical equivalent of black hole evaporation. And the people involved are, of course, Bill Andrew and Maurizio Ricards. Maurizio, he's with us for a year. He's a PhD student in Brazil. Matt Penrice, he's an undergraduate student who helps us building the equipment, and he's doing now his honors project with us. And surprisingly, to testing our trust in effective field theory in curved space-time, there are two civil engineering people on our team, and that is Professor Greg Lawrence and Ted Tedford. Ted just finished his PhD and is now a postdoc, and I'm just very excited to work with these people, and actually I have to say I've learned a lot of physics from the engineering people. So let me start. So here is what I want to convince you about. So first of all, I say there is an effective field theory, a little foreign model out there in nature that has an emergent Lorentz symmetry with respect to the maximum propagation speed in the system, which is here the speed of sound. And that is basically you approach this speed of sound, the maximum propagation speed, in the infrared limit, and always in the scales of the system. On top of that, it is capable of exhibiting effective black and white hole horizons. And what I'm saying with that, that's not just happening on the paper. You can really set them up. You can set up a particular system such that you see black and white hole horizons. Then, what I'm also telling you, we actually do these experiments in an undergraduate civil engineering laboratory. So they have what we're using is a flume tank, and we have that as long as the students don't need it to do the experiment. So, and then at the end, I want to make a point. So I want to raise a general question. How much, if in this particular system, which actually has some microscopic, some fundamental structure beneath it, there is some mean field regime, there's this emergent, effective field theory in curved space-time emergent, but below that, there is some true microscopic structure, and there are a lot of scales in that. And I'm saying if we are seeing a classical equivalence, and I will, classical Hawking radiation, I will explain you what I mean with that, then this will be a very, this would ensure our trust in effective field theories in curved space-time. So I have to say we haven't seen it quite, but I want to convince you that we are that close to see it or not, depending on if it's there. So I want to start, since that's a colloquium and there are people from various different fields, I want to tell you why it is possible to have such system. And I said very basic, I don't want to lose anybody. And so for a lot of people might be bored, but let's start from the basics. So in 1915, Albert Einstein came up with a new theory for gravity. And there are two important things, and that is, first of all, that gravity is a consequence of space-time geometry. Right? So the gravitational field is a metric tensor, a metric rank two tensor, symmetric tensor. On top of that, he also gave us the tools to how to find this metric tensor. And that are basically the dynamical equations. So Einstein gravity are these two things. So one thing is, of course, that having a gravitational field, having a geometrical interpretation of gravity, means that gravity in some sense is a forceless theory. Objects are just freely following geodesics through the curved space-time. So now the question is, can I actually have something like that without having, with maybe coming from a very different set of dynamical equations? And the answer actually is yes. There are some little toy models out there all around us. Everybody has looked at water, or some more fancy models like Bose-Einstein condensate, superfluids, electromagnetic waveguides. And they have this feature. So how does this work? So I have some dynamical equations for some various systems. For example, as I just mentioned, right, we will focus on fluids here. and I will tell you why we will focus on fluids. And then I will show you that at some limit, you can get a notion of a geometrical interpretation for small excitations in the system. So how did it all get started? And that was in, when was it? I think it was, okay, 1982. Bill had this idea. He told me he was teaching fluid dynamics, and he got this idea looking at sound waves. So what Bill looked at is a very simple, I mean, fluid dynamics is not simple, but he looked at he made some restriction. He said it's vorticity free, so that you can write the velocity field as a gradient of some field phi, scalar field phi. Then he said it's incompressible, and that means that the material derivative of a small of the density is zero. So if you're on the fluid flow, you're following the flow, that's the material derivative, which is basically the ordinary time derivative if V is equal to zero. So incompressible means that even if you have small perturbations, they are negligible, they won't change the overall density of your flow. Inviscid, so you have very high Reynolds numbers, which means if you look at the flow, you won't form turbulences and things like that. Of course, these are all idealizations, and I will actually come back to that in when we said about experiments. One thing, actually, which is very nice, there's a lot of nice ways to understand this thing, vorticity-free. For example, I can have a draining fluid, right? If you're in your basin, you wash your hands, and then water is draining down. And you see, of course, it can be vorticity-free. Local irrotational means locally irrotational. So if you would take, for example, you fill your bathtub up with water, and you pull the plug, and while you're doing it, you throw little papers on it with arrows, right? And when you see them draining down, when they're draining, you see when they're flowing down, when they drain, you see that the arrows won't change locally. So this means locally irrotational. So now, what are the equations to describe the equations of motion, the dynamic equations for such a system? Well, we have, and that's very simple math, I mean, that's undergraduate physics. So we have the continuity equation, it's all conservation equations, continuity equation, the Euler equation, right? So basically, it's always, you can phrase this in terms of the material derivative equation. So here I have the background flow times rho, the density of the system is some force. Here it's just a gradient of the pressure, we don't have any additional forces. And the equation of state is just that the pressure is some function of rho. So, and what did Bill do? He looked at little sound waves. And his idea was the following. So he looked, if you want to calculate how things propagate through, for example, you throw a stone into the water, how the sound waves propagate in a medium, he had this realization that it depends very much what the background is doing. So he wanted to see what is the relative motion of the sound waves on a flowing on a background with some flow velocity. So he perturbed, and what he derived is actually, he had this idea that what if the sound waves could actually propagate, if the background flow could speed up so much that it propagates faster than the speed of sound in the system. So if it goes supersonic, for example, supercritical. So this was the idea, let's get to it. So what he found when he looks at little perturbations, let me go back. So this would be the density of the fluid plus a small fluctuation, the pressure plus a small fluctuation. That was basically the, right, remember, so that is my field, which the gradient of that gives me my velocity field. So, and then he looked at the excitation spectrum, and he found a very nice and smart way to write it in this particular manner. So now I'm having an equation only for this field phi. And he wrote this equation, and that equation is a wave equation on a curved space-time background. So what he had to do for that, he had to make, he defined this object here, which is a symmetrical rank 2 tensor. So he defined it, and by defining that, he could rewrite the excitation spectrum in this really nice and beautiful form. So if we look at this geometry, what do we see? There is the density, right? Then here's the speed of sound. then, and here's the background flow. So of course you have to do a little bit more a thorough analysis, but what we say usually, I mean, a good indication where the horizon is, that is equal to zero, right? You have to look at killing vectors and so forth. But look what happened if these things equal, if the speed of sound equals the background velocity, G naught naught in our space-time, emerging space-time geometry becomes zero. So how can we understand what's happening here? Let's look at some situation out in nature. We have a very particular waterfall, which let's say this point here, put it further out there, there is a lake or it's completely, the water is almost at rest. So I'm throwing a stone into the water, and what I'm seeing is how the sound waves propagate through this water, right? And the different colors indicate different time points. So if I see from yellow and a second later maybe, it's the orange one and so forth. So they propagate homogeneously in all directions. So if I'm throwing a stone in here, someone on this side or on that side, on both sides, will get the sound, the signal at the same time, equally fast. So if I'm now coming closer to the waterfall and the water is going this direction, what I'm seeing, if I'm throwing a little stone in here, that the sound waves propagate faster in this direction than against the flow. So downstream, they propagate faster than upstream. And of course, you can imagine there is a point, let's say, we have a very fancy waterfall, and suddenly it becomes supersonic. So what's happening at the point, there is a point that sound waves will not propagate at all in the other direction. Everything has to propagate this way. So when I'm throwing a stone in here, someone being out there would never see my sound waves. This is what we call the supercritical region, and here this will be the equivalent of our inside of the black hole. So how can we understand that? So instead of having light, we now have as a maximum propagation speed, what did emerge is a Lorentz symmetry with respect to the speed of sound in this particular system. So how does that work, right? If I'm now saying, right, so I have something very nice, but when does this actually hold, right? You make a lot of assumptions. You're surely it's water, but there is something beneath it. So what is the validity and what can I do with that? Is there something in gravity, right, which does not touch the dynamical part, which only actually uses the geometrical interpretation of GR? So what can I actually mimic with this thing? So usually if we have the Einstein equation, we get some solutions, and these are the space-time solutions such as black holes, Robertson Walker space-times, and so forth. So now you can, for example, say, let's say, even so, there is some fundamental theory of quantum gravity. Let's say there are some effects where the gravitational field can be considered to be classical. So that is a valid approximation as long as we say whatever the gravitational field, if some quantum field, some matter field coupled to it, that they want, and you create some particles, let's say that those are small enough that they will not affect the space-time, the background geometry. So you in the realm within semi-classical quantum gravity without back reaction. So this is what you do. You take your space-time to be classical, and you take some quantum fields, and you put them together by replacing the Minkowski space-time with some general curved space-time background. And then what can you do? So people looked at this and studied particular solutions. They looked at black hole evaporation, so black holes, what happens at the horizon of black holes, some quantum effect. Then people looked at super radiant wave scattering, that is a classical and quantum as well. So for example, if I have a rotating black hole, I have an ergosphere. And if you send in a little wave and you see how it scatters, how it comes out again, because if a wave enters the ergosphere, it has this frame dragging, but it can still escape. And what you see, what's coming out of there can be, there is a possibility of amplifying so that you're coming out with a higher amplitude as you send in. So the frequency stays the same. It's a stationary problem. The wave gets into the ergosphere and comes out again with a higher amplitude. So it effectively carried away, actually its norm is carried away, and this way you can gain energy out of a rotating black hole. So, and then of course we have cosmological particle reduction, because if you look at quantum fields, for example, on an effectively on a time-dependent space-time background, how it looks like you have a parametrically excited harmonic oscillator. You can cast the equation into this form. And then, of course, you can excite quasi-particles. So these are the facts we have. So we know already from before that we are able, actually, in these analogs to set up black holes. So what is necessary, right? So we have this other picture where we have some hydrodynamic equations. We have our emergent spacetime plus an effective field theory. So let me stress this again. What you get at the same time is not just a notion of geometry. What you really get is quantum field theory in curved spacetime. You get the whole set of equations coming out. We got the wave equation on a general curved spacetime. So that is what we get. So basically, we get it at that level here. And if we now look at this and say, okay, how can I actually, can I get black hole evaporation, right? So first of all, we need to be sure that there is an acoustic horizon. And that's a very subtle issue, of course, right? Also because there is some subtraction, we'll come back to that a little bit. But the other thing is also the validity of the effective description. That brings us back, actually. So when is that actually a good approximation? So one thing is, of course, since I'm only interested in this feature here, I don't want that the real dynamics, the true dynamics, carries through to my system. So I have to make sure, how did we derive that, right? We derived it through a linearization process. So I have to make sure that we really stay within the linear regime, that we do not need to look into back reaction and things like that. So that's what one has to assure. You have to be within the realms of the linearization scheme, because this way, the dynamics will not carry through to the system. Yeah? So if you look at this, this is the wave equation we get, right? And that is the metric geometry. So now, of course, this C and V, oh, that's a good point, I should have said that, that can be functions of time and space. Ah, okay, let me write it out. Sorry about that. So GIB is proportional. There's an overall conformal factor. This T depends on the spatial dimensionality of the system. So if you look at surface waves, it's 2 plus 1. If you look at sound waves, it's 3 plus 1. So now what we have here, right, is minus that C squared minus V squared. And here I have minus Vx minus Vy minus Vz. And so it goes down. Right? And here I have 1, 0, 0, 1, 0, 1, 0. So they are all actually on the spatial slice. They're conformally flat. That has some consequences, for example, because it has been shown that you cannot cast the Kerr solution, a rotating black hole, into something that's conformally flat on the spatial slice. That means all the kind of analogs we have so far are actually not capable of mimicking the whole Kerr solution. But luckily, we can mimic actually the equatorial slice. And in that slice, we still have the ergo region and all these things. So we get all the features coming in.
I presume you're going to talk about quantum effects?
I'm coming to that. So I will tell you that quantum effects, we cannot. So this would mean we look at the temperature, right? Something which gets a quantum effect, there's no stimulation, it gets feed out of the vacuum. And the temperature would be too small to detect because the background temperature is too big. Right?
Mechanics. Right. The short distance, so, physics of the fluid. Perhaps right. In a superfluid, this would be okay, but in a normal fluid, I don't think you can extend this to the quantum regime.
So that's exactly the point here, right? The point is how much, when I'm looking at the black hole evaporation process, how much does it actually probe of the fundamental structure? You know, if I have, take a Bose-Einstein condensate, right? It's a superfluid. I have the same analogy. I can excite quasi particles. And I can actually, there is a regime where you can completely forget about the microscopic structure, substructure of the condensate. So, and it's exactly that's what we're testing. Because if quantum gravity, for example, if you look
in at... In a superfluid, you'll be testing that. But in a normal fluid, you cannot even use these equations for quantum mechanics.
Right. But actually, I'm telling you now that when I made the initial statement, I said we look at classical equivalence of photon radiation. We look at stimulated process. If you give me a little bit more time, we will send in sound waves to stimulate that. We have classical effects. And still, there's a non-adiabatic regime. And we can actually say that we create negative frequency loss. Classical, right? So I'm here. So this is a space-time geometry, and maybe I should have said that the spacular background velocity can be a function, can be dependent on space and time. Here, of course, the speed of sound is being taken incompressible, so it will not be a function of time, but it can still be a function of space. But that we get to this. So that was the original analogy, and then we were here and we're saying, okay, when can I actually? I think I stopped here, so when can I use this to mimic here? So to actually look at the black hole evaporation process or classical equivalent. So the other thing is, and that is an expression actually, how about this sign here? When can I use this description by neglecting the Einstein equation, its true dynamics? Because if we want to compare two systems, these two systems, right, if I want to mimic that or any of these effects using one of my emergent spacetimes or toy models, I have to make sure that the effect which I want to test is not related to it's not due to some dynamics. For example, black holes hard thermodynamics is something we could not test because it's intrinsically due to the dynamic of the Einstein equation. So that is the question. So what we have to be within, the effect we want to mimic has to be within the realms of semi-classical quantum gravity, and from the analogy side, it has to be within the linearization scheme. So what are our assumptions? Let's go back to quantum gravity versus quantum field theory in curved space-time. So the assumptions are that, of course, the gravitational field is classical. Sorry, just say classical here, right? It's classical. It does not get, there's no back reaction. And that, of course, we also say that when I write down my effective field theory on this curved spacetime, that the effective field theory holds on all scales. So now there is a little bit of a problem here, because if you look at the Hawking process, right, then you look at there is this enormous blue shift if you come closer to the horizon. So if you calculate the blue shift of the mode, if you look where a mode comes from, that this originally comes out of a black hole, this thermal radiation, if you look at the standard derivation, that you see it is blue shifted to an enormous extent, and it's blue shifted beyond the Planck length. So basically, how can we explain that? Is Hawking radiation then really testing the Planck regime, or can we trust this, or is Hawking radiation actually some effect that is due to the infrared? It's an infrared effect. So the problem is,
conclusion here, it's valid because in the usual case, the metric, you have a notion of what does it mean to measure energy at infinity or close to the horizon, right? But here, this metric is an artifact. So why are you comparing?
Because when you follow the derivation, basically, this blue shift, if you look at, for example, Hawking's or Hawking's original paper, or you read this paper by Bill Andrew, you see that actually this, when you do the derivation, that the quantum field modes seem to be blue shifted to this extent. I can actually, if you like, we can discuss this later in more detail.
But is that the artifact of a calculation, or is it supposing I calculate?
That's what we want to find out, right?
But supposing I did, you know, the Polchinski's nice slice thing where I leave the time, the static hypersurfaces, and so I go to the horizon in a time dependent way, so I see the origin of the radiation differently. Is it true that in those kind of calculations right. You get.
So what I'm actually saying, and I'm coming to this, there is a way to test this by modifying your field theory, by adding higher spatial derivatives, by saying, what if I still trust my effective field theory, but I say already at that level I get some modification, some Lorentz symmetry breaking, for example. And then I'm seeing is the Hawking radiation, is it robust against a modification like that? Because if I tamper with my field theory, my effective field theory in the ultraviolet, and still the effect is robust against this modification, then I know, I'm sure, and this is just an artifact of the derivation.
Well, I guess the thing I worry about is that the spirit of Bill's argument was always like saying that if I have a low energy collision and I go by it at high speed, it looks like it's high energy calculation. And it's not, for an effective field theory to work, it doesn't have to be that all frames see a low energy process. It just has to exist in frames that see a low energy process. And so the fact that a calculation looks like it's looking at high frequency modes may not be sufficient for the breakdown at all of the frequency.
Exactly. And I'm agreeing with you.
Okay, good.
I'm just saying how, because this is the standard derivation we have. So now what we can also do, but in general there is a question, right? Even if the derivation we're looking at is bad, and we would even find one which cures us without modifying the field theory, right? The effective field theory, adding Lorentz symmetry breaking terms. There's still a question, right? Because we don't know exactly what is the effective field theory in curved spacetime, because we don't have quantum gravity. So what people would do, for example, ad hoc, add some higher derivative terms, for example, in cosmology, and see how would a particular effect, you know, how would some particle production process alter if you add, you know, extra, you play around with the effective field theory. For example, if you encounter Lorentz symmetry breaking under Lipschitz gravity. You can test that, right? You can test the robustness of a particular effect.
Yeah, I guess the reason I'm resisting a little bit is that it seems to me that the gravity is kind of it's something that makes it look hard, but it's essentially you're asking a time-dependent issue. So if I just forgot gravity and I had a magnetic field and I looked at lambda levels and I turned the magnetic field off, and all these lambda levels collapse down to a continuum, and those things are coming in from infinity all the time, and I could have made the same kind of statements that you're making there in that case, and there's no gravity at all. But I wouldn't be arguing there that Maxwell's equations are failing. I would expect things to come down in the adiabatic vacuum, and I wouldn't worry about it. Like, if I turn off magnetic fields in the lab, I don't expect, you know, transplanking physics to explode on me or anything, so.
Okay. I think the statement I want to make here is a bit subtle. I'm saying something before. What if the real theory, we don't have quantum gravity, right? So what we
what I'm trying to not say in terms of gravitation, but in terms of, say, magnetic fields, where it's easier to think about.
But what if I don't quite understand why you're so unhappy with that if I'm saying I don't know exactly what my effective field theory around the black hole should be. What if there are some terms that would spoil the effect? What if, you know, if I have my full-fledged field theory and I look at it, and I notice that depending on what kind of terms you add to your theory in the ultraviolet would basically make it impossible that the process would break down. That's a standard thing actually they're doing in cosmology in all these kind of field theories in curved spacetime, where they ad hoc to some like quantum gravity phenomenology add extra terms and see if this effect will change. That's something which I don't know. It's not really. I mean, it's quite standard.
But it just, I guess, it's worrisome if there's a better understood example where you don't need those terms and they're not relevant, right?
So I'm making this point because if I'm taking my analog, right, Hess is exactly the same because it is only like an approximation. It's a toy model. In some limits, it looks like a quantum field theory in a curved space. Then beyond that, it changes. And already at the level of the, you know, you have a modified dispersion relation, right? And this means you have higher spatial derivatives in your theory anyway. And then there's also the fact that there is some microscopic, there's some fundamental cutoff in there that is the molecular distance in your system. And all I'm saying now is, if you don't like it that I'm making these thoughts in quantum gravity, right? Then at least you have to say, if I want to have used a toy model, I have to convince you that if I'm looking for a particular effect, that this effect should be robust against model-specific alterations in the ultraviolet, right?
I'm happy to argue with you longer, but why don't we do it offline?
See the whole outcome, and then we'll come back.
Yeah.
I'll come back and ask you later.
Oh, my God. I'm running late. So you see I'm on slide 9 from 49. That's not a good sign. Experimental investigation is impossible, right? You can look at it. So what can we do to, even though some of you might not agree, but still it would be nevertheless nice to have to see Hawking radiation, to measure it, which, you know, observe it, which is impossible. And I'm suggesting we should actually experimentally verify the process. So the problem is, as I pointed out, and So I have a molecular structure. This is not the whole story. There are some scales in my system, and I have a molecular structure. So now, actually, we were discussing about this. So it was actually, if you want to see, so the fact that, you know, these hydrodynamic equations are really made out, you know, this is not a fundamental theory. How can I actually, you know, take into account that there is some molecular substructure? And the idea was to, instead of having a standard dispersion relation, so that was Ted Jacobs who actually said, you don't need to know all the microscopic degrees of freedom. You don't need to know the fundamental theory. You can just look at the level of the effective field theory and add some higher modified, work with a modified dispersion relation. And what they looked at, and this was a very reasonable thing, if you plot omega over k, right, you have sub and supraluminal, right? These are the two cases they investigated, and check if you would actually modify your field theory, what would happen to the Hawking process? Is it robust again? Yes, it is robust. You cannot prove it in general, but for some certain cases, they've shown that. And this kind of behavior, actually, if you would like to use some effective field theory, which has something like that, so Parabra, for example, would be trans-Bogoliubov, it would be up to k to the 6. So Bogoliubov would be, so that is k squared, that would be k fourth, and then you would have k to the 6 up to the k to the 6. That would be the modification in dispersion relation. So that is, and basically you recover Lorentz symmetry in this analog only in the infrared limit, only for small k value. So the problem is now, as we said already, we want to drive, in order to have an acoustic black hole horizon in my system, I have to drive a flow supercritical. And we know if we do this for sound waves in water, that what basically happens, you get these shock waves. And if you look at this, a shock wave moves fast. So when an object moves faster than the information about it can be propagated into the surrounding fluid, fluid near the disturbance cannot react or get out of the way. Before the disturbance arrives, in a shock wave, the properties of the fluid change almost instantaneously. I would say then we are within the realms of the dynamics, so we cannot use sound waves. So the way out of that, I also want to make a little bit of point. Why did it take so long, right, to from the time they came up with the analogs to now actually look at it experimentally? And my first point was it was exactly the same. I have something different than gravity. Does it still work, right? To look at effective field theories, to come up with the idea to modify the dispersion relation. And now we're at the stage, okay, this should work, but yet for the experiment we need more. We need a system that actually can set up such a scenario. And then I'm saying, what if we take sound waves in water, and now I'm making a point and saying, that's a bad system because you can form shock waves. And then you back to the dynamics of the fluid dynamics, and you don't want that. You want to actually have a supercritical region without touching this, you know, the dynamics. So, and Bill Andrew and Ralph Schitzel actually suggested to look at surface waves. So what are surface waves? They're neither longitudinal or transversal waves. They are circular waves. And the advantage is you can actually play with them around. You can tamper with them. And the way to do it is you set a shallow water wave, what's called gravity wave, as we see in the ocean or in an open channel flow. And you can play around with that. Right. So, and I think I have to speed up a little bit, but it's actually not so easy. What is the effective field theory for surface waves? And I need to really speed up. So I'm just telling you, if you have a system like that, you would write down your velocity. It's still irrotational and incompressible. So you split up your, you can write down your velocity field as such, and this will be just the XDT, right? And then if you look at the continuity equation, it has to be equal to zero, and you can expand around now the flat background, and you can make a Taylor expansion instead. So, and we derived this effective field theory, and actually we're just working on it because also it's some approximation, this is known. If you have a very careful look, it's much more interesting, and we're just working on that actually. So how did we do it? You have basically the equation I've shown you before, then you impose some boundary condition here on the surface, the velocity has to vanish, and on the free surface, you want to have this condition. So where h is the height of the flow, and if you do this, you also have the Euler equation. So you can actually see that the field depends on, so this function now here, phi naught, so phi n is basically a phi right, so and then evaluated around z equals 0. So this phi n has no set dependence in there anymore. So and if you look at that, so then this phi naught basically is just the field only dependent on x and y, then and this phi 1 will be the first derivative. And you can show with a boundary condition, if you have a flat background, that you can set this to 0 and you only have an equation for that. But there's an infinite power, an infinite series of derivatives showing up.
Expansion, because you started looking at the hydrodynamics, which is pretty much a truncation, I would say. So what do you mean?
So I can only give you one very good argument why it's working, because people have tested the dispersion relation in water, right? And we then, when you go to the Eichenwald approximation and you derive it, it actually is exactly what we see in nature. So this dispersion relation seems to work very well. And again, we're exactly having the question which I want to basically, what I want to stress here. You should, because, you know, at some stage, right, you should get out of the realms of the hydrodynamic equations, right, because there are the water molecules below. But still, you can write down effective field series, and it seems to
you
work.
You can do this, but I'm saying that, you know, in the hydrodynamics, there are two. If I start adding high derivative, you know, high gradient corrections with arbitrary coefficients, my solution will change, right?
Yes, of course.
So how can I trust any predictions that come out of?
Sorry, what do you mean the solution will change? I'm now solving for phi, right? And I'm looking at small. At the end, I will look for small perturbations in phi.
So we can always look at the linearized fluctuations.
That's what I'm doing.
Right. That's fine. We can stay there. But I'm saying that the hydrodynamics, which are conservation bosons of stress energy terms, imply derivative expansion of the velocity gradients. Looks like what you are doing, you are truncating to the first gradient, but you're not looking at the high gradients as an equation of motion.
No, actually, I will show you. We'll take the, if you actually, you know that water has the dispersion, I mean, for the ground state, right, actually, we also found out you have to do this for the ground state. This is how we got interested in that. You have to take this into account, right, for the flow itself. But if you look at water, and I'm coming to this anyway, but so if you look at it, it has these two regimes, right, which is the linear regime, the shallow water waves, the deep water waves, the capillary waves. It has these three regimes. This is a momentum space. If you map this onto position space, you get an infinite order of special derivatives. It said the anisotropy in the system is the infinite. Surely at some stage you don't trust this field theory anymore, but to this is how water, I mean, this have looked at this. This does work. So, we do this, and we derive our, so I don't want to get into nitty-gritty details, but let's just say we do this, you trust me that we've done this analysis in the right way. And then what I'm getting is an equation for my perturbations. And these T1 and T2 are now complicated. They basically have a series of derivatives, infinite series of spatial derivatives in there. And a way to rephrase this now, we can also write this in this particular form. So here now, this FIB would be the first term. If I'm only taking the first term in T1 and T2, and I put this into FIB, and all the other terms I put in this F tilde AB. And I can write this down, and this description here gives me my effective, my gives me for this limit here, basically, I get this, I recover Lorentz symmetry with respect to the speed of sound, and I can write down this wave equation on a curved spacetime. And this modification here, basically, we evaluated the next order, and what you see, you get higher order spatial derivatives in it. If you look carefully, you get two more derivatives, and basically, so this would lead to this branch. So that would be just the first approximation. But that's just to show you how it would look like. So this is the effective, if you take more, if you're not making this assumption, you're not only looking at shallow water waves, if you're taking more into account, you will see that the effective field theory in position space, right, encounters these higher order derivatives. So now let's go to the Eichenholz approximation, where we basically Fourier transform this part, and that is a good transformation. That is, this transformation holds or is valid in the realm if the bottom of the flume tank is not changing, if you have some surface weight, if the bottom is not changing or slowly changing. And then you can derive basically the speed of sound for the system and its expansion. And if you also include, which we haven't done here in the derivation, to make it simpler, if you also include surface tension, this is a full dispersion relation. So how does it look like? I can plot all the branches. Here I plot K and here I plot omega. And I'm seeing, for example, so as I said, that's a shallow water regime linear, where the analogy where I have this emerging Lorentz symmetry with respect to the sound. Then I have this deep water regime, and then I have a capillary, which basically has these three different dominant parts. First is this linear, and the speed is basically proportional to the square root of g times h. G is the gravity constant, 9.81, and so forth. And this h is the height of the flow. So by making the height smaller, I can slow down my surface weight. And remember what we had in mind is we wanted that there's a point when the flow exceeds the speed of sound in the system. And that is where it's equal, there's a horizon, there's no black hole horizon. So by having a system, by just changing the height of my basin, I can actually change the speed, the propagation speed, and I can very easily set up black hole and white hole horizons. So that is why the surface waves, right, are such a nice model to look at it. So then we have here this intermediate part, the deep water ones are dominated by the tang part. And then, of course, the tang, if you go to high k, goes to 1, and you're basically left with this. But at high k, it's the k to the 3. So it's superluminal, and it's basically when the surface tension, that is the surface tension, plays a role, gets dominant. So if you now send in a wavelength with a certain frequency, you can excite these two modes. The up and down, so basically you always have, if you would have a flow. So first, this is at rest, so there's no flow, and I can assign the modes with positive frequency mode with plus and minus K. This is what I'm assigning. If I'm now switching on some flow, if I'm going through some flow channel, this dispersion relation changes. Because you have this relation here, right, you have to take this into account. So what you're actually getting is now you bend this curve, and you see there would be the possibility, it's a really bad picture actually in some reason. So if you look at this, I'm now plotting something else. Right, and I'm sending in a wave, there would be two possibilities to excite with two wavelengths. But usually you excite this one, right, and it cannot jump into this one because of conservation of momentum. So and just plotted all of it, this will be the negative frequency part, that's the positive frequency part. So now we want to actually set up such a system, and the motivation came from a paper that came out in 2009, and that was by Jean-Marc Rousseau and collaborators. And they claimed that actually they would have seen negative frequency modes. They claimed they've seen classical equivalent of Hawking radiation. And we looked at this paper and we said their setup is very nice, but we don't trust the results. Because the characteristics they had negative frequency wave with the wrong frequency. What do I mean with that? You would set up a stationary flow, and I will show you how we do that. And if it's stationary, the problem means that the frequency should always stay the same. The wavelength is changing, but the frequency is the same. It is stationary. So if you whatever you affect you want to see has a higher frequency than the one you sent in, you know already it's not a nonlinear effect, right? So in this sense, we knew there was something wrong. They also said they have negative frequency modes. Even so, they have no horizon in the system if they're close to that, which is exactly what we think, because if you have higher negative frequency modes, we're thinking this looks like a nonlinearity, right? So if you have, for example, breaking off modes, you can get things like that, and you don't need a horizon for that. So this was consistent. And then also that what we found out, their system really had, the way they set it up, later on we found there was separation of law, and I will explain you what this means. So separation of law, I can say quickly actually, it's you form turbulences, and if you have turbulences in your system, right, you cannot really say you have an irritation of law, and so the whole thing, the whole initial approximation are not that valid anymore. And also it causes some others, and you don't know how to analyze your system very well, actually, if you have separation of law. So you're looking at our lab. That is the lab to test the Hawking variation. That is our plume tank. Very spectacular, right? So here, this is our plume tank, and doesn't look like much. However, this is how then when we have the experiment, so we would have a flow which going this way. This is the obstacle, the flow goes over it. And here, this thing, so basically I will show you here the black, and you see this tip, and there's a white hole horizon. This meaning in this region, the flow is super critical. Things that come from this side from the wall can just go through. They enter the black hole and come out again. But things which I'm sending in from here reach the white hole horizon, and if you see nicely, right, this perturbation stops here. I will show you a whole picture. I mean, you cannot be convinced, and, you know, maybe say it's just you will see more. So we have a wave generator here, which generates surface waves. They come in till they hit the white hole horizon, and then there's some nice physics happening. So what we actually do, basically, we shut down all the lights, and there we have some projectors that shine the lights, have a light sheet in the center of the flow along, and then what we do, we take pictures, and we take 8 seconds a frame, because that's the best we can do at the moment, and then we actually take a MATLAB program to read out this line, right? And then we can have, for every picture, we get one line in our wave characteristics, and I'll show you that. And then we can see what we've sent in and what's coming out of the horizon. So what is the problem? So first what we did, these are our three obstacles to create black and white whole horizons, right? So what we started with was actually, that was as in Germain's paper, where he suggested that is their shape, right? And we just scaled everything down because their plume tank is, this obstacle in their tank, I think, is 14 meters long. Ours is 1 meter long. We have a very small plume tank. And at the beginning, we were very worried that, because then, of course, friction and so on would play a big role. Turns out, we were really lucky that we didn't have a big plume tank, because we could use it every day. It was very easy to manipulate it and get a good grasp on it, and you could just play around with it. And it turns out also, like, for example, if you have a huge wave tank and the wave generator is far away, you have to send in huge waves, and of course, the amplitude of the wave relatively to the height kind of gives you it in a non-linear regime, right? So we were really lucky to have this very small and simple plume tank, and what we actually did, we put the obstacle in there, and then, of course, you see these sharp edges, and when water streams over, there's the question, does it matter if you have the sharp edges here? And what we did, we put little raising particles in our fluid, and you see the streaks, you can see what the fluid does. And you see very clearly, I mean, actually, we don't have really nice pictures, but it's, what you can see, the flow goes over here, and you have all these turbulences here, right? So, and turbulences mean that you have separation of flow, and that some layers stream faster than the other ones, right? They separate. This layer here goes down, while this one just streams on top of them. So what we did, we took something, okay, we know from fluid dynamics, and also from if you have wings for airplanes and so on, if you take a particular shape, which are designed as such, that you avoid these turbulences. So we took just the shape, which we know from fluid dynamics and airstreams and so on, and they are designed specially. And then what we did, we just took twice the height of that to say, you know what, let's just make two of them, because we also know something about the effect we want to know. We know that this flow behavior will not be as nice as that one, but still we want to have two of them here because we can have a faster change in the flow velocity. So here our wave generator, and there is some actually nice, I wanted to show you something which I find interesting. So the difference between the steep water waves, which are basically in this regime here, or shallow water waves, which are here, the difference is how basically the circular motion is. For deep water waves, it's round, and here for shallow water waves, it's elliptic. And what's also interesting, what is the negative frequency mode in the system, that you could ask, so if I have something like that, and the flow is going this way, that would be a positive frequency mode. a negative frequency mode would be something like that. So what I also find interesting, what we want to show is at the end of our flume tank, there is this gate here, and the water flows over it. And you would set up a flow, and when it flows over this crest here, after a while it becomes stationary. And I think we are convinced that either it's closed, but it seems that over this crest it will always be such that there is a black hole horizon there, meaning that, so in some sense you can permit that nothing from this side can propagate back into it. So it's just like a protection. And if you look at some waterfalls or things like that going over stone, you see that the surface is always very, very smooth. And it's, if you play around with these things, you see it's impossible that you send something back in. Because if this is a black hole arising from this direction, nothing can enter coming from here. So, and you can, of course, you can calculate, we need to calculate the flow rates and so forth. And it's not trivial, it's not difficult either. And I thought maybe, you know, it's good to see the wave. So that's our wave generator here. This is the stress we were also describing. We put some, to make it, you know, for the detection, we put some coloring thing in there. And you see the wave come. You can follow the wave. Here, it hits the white hole horizon and cannot go through. So. And if you look, I don't know. We have to make nice movies because you really have to see the whole film time to be convinced that it's not going through. But anyway, so that is our experiment. And so what we do, we take pictures of this region. You see, this is our light sheet, it's in line. So what do you want to see, right? Because that was a question was raised at the beginning, and people say, oh, you shouldn't see anything. But it's actually not true. So if there are adiabatic and non-adiabatic conversion effects, and that's what we are actually focusing on. We look at a wave that comes in, hits the white hole horizon, and want to see what's coming out. And adiabatic ones are where you still stay within the positive frequency regime, but you know the wavelength from the thing that comes out is different from the wavelengths I've sent into it. There was a paper on that which you found in the 80s, but I think nobody else has, and also this paper hasn't really detected it clearly, has shown that at this white hole horizon, there are, due to the fact that there is a white hole horizon, there are transitions from shallow to deep water. And then I will also explain there's a transition from deep to capillary. So how does it work? A shallow water, one has to say, you have to look at the propagation speed of this thing. So first of all, notice that the speed here, the group velocity, which is just tangential. So we all know, of course, that the group velocity regroup is the omega dk, and the phase velocity is the omega is omega by k. So now, of course, omega here changes, right, in this different regime. And so the group velocity is the important thing. And what we see is, of course, a shallow water wave propagates faster than a deep water wave. What this means, so I send a shallow water wave here, I send a shallow water wave in, and that has a very high propagation speed till it hits the horizon, right? Of course, when it moves up the obstacle, its wavelengths will change. Because remember that the speed of it is proportional to h. And if h gets smaller, then of course also its propagation gets smaller. But so till it hits the white hole horizon, and then I will show you it gets converted into a deep water wave, which now has a slower propagation velocity and cannot has to move downstream. So you send something in which is faster, goes upstream till it hits the white hole horizon, gets converted to a deep water wave, and gets and has to move downstream because it doesn't have enough propagation. So in some sense, that is also why you can form this white hole horizon. Because think about it, right? If there wouldn't be a mechanism to take away this energy, water would just send these waves in, and they would keep on piling up. But because we have this dispersion relation, because we have anisotropic scaling built into this system, that's why you can effectively carry away energy. So I will actually now skip a little bit, because so this one we have detected and seen. This one here we have seen with the naked eye. There's a second conversion from deep water wave to papillary wave. But the problem is you can see it with the naked eyes, but because they're so small capillary waves, we cannot, we need a better camera. So this is why we haven't recorded that yet. So at the wide holoride. So then I will explain you there are some non-adiabatic effects, but actually there's a part of it will be converted to this deep water wave. The other part will be converted to a negative frequency wave. And that's what we call the classical equivalence of Fokin radiation. So, and I skipped the other things. There are many more things we want to do. But for now, let's look at this paper. So the first week, honestly, we did these things. We saw this conversion. And at some stage, then someone sent us this paper. It's a very old paper. And this guy basically has seen this conversion. And I'm just quickly explaining how it works, because that's the main principle. And then I'll show you all of this up. Good. So instead of explaining in this picture, I can also explain it in this picture. Right? So I'm starting with something like that. And then I have, of course, my fluid flow, which has two solutions. That is what I'm sending in. Then when I come closer to the horizon, what happens is I bend the dispersion relation for the sound wave down. And of course, through the continuity equation, what's happening is that the flow speeds up, because it has to go through a smaller area, right? So the flow gets faster, this gets deeper. So what I'm plotting here is omega naught plus Vk, right? What I'm plotting here, and that is my omega k. So and now I'm looking at, this is basically the solution. When I'm coming closer, in order to simplify it, I'm just writing this now, right? What would happen is, till it hits a point when this line is actually tangential, means it's equal to the group velocity, and that's where our vital horizon sits. So it's here. So before, again, let me stress this, from here to here, it cannot jump because of conservation of momentum. When it hits a vital horizon, we'll sit here. And then it's exactly in between shoreline deep water regime. When it then comes out again, it comes out here. So you send this in, and you get this out. And that, of course, how did we do it? How did we explain it? We used, in some sense, this Eichenholz approximation, these things which I showed you already, right, where we didn't really take into account that the height is changing and so on. It's a crude picture. However, we have seen that in the lab, right? So it is working. We try to get a better grasp on the effective field theory here. And what we see basically is exactly this conversion effect from a shallow water wave to a deep water wave. And then there should be, in principle, a second conversion for the deep water wave to capillary, but since I'm running a little bit late, I might just go on. So, okay, so what we do, we can actually see what we do, so we have our two obstacles, and we have a program written in MATLAB which does it all for us. All you need to give it, like the height of the fluid, we have all these things, we keep it in, and it gives us, this is just for us to get a first grasp on it. And you see these different lines, actually, because as I told you, the dispersion relation depends on if I'm a WKB approximation, which is that I'm saying, I'm assuming that everything, that height is varying slowly, I'm assuming at that particular point that it's approximately a plane, a sinusoidal, or a nice oscillatory wave. So then what I'm saying here with a particular wavelength and so forth corresponding to the height at that very instant. So we are really in the realm within adiabatic regime. Things are slowing, changing slowly. And what we plotted here is basically one is where we start climbing up our obstacle, and we plotted the dispersion relation for this. And then what we see, we have a wave generator which operates on different, you know, percentages, meaning different incoming frequencies. And we know already, in order to see this conversion effect, this thing here has to be tangential. That's now a different picture, which I'm using if you go from, it's confusing, but if you go from this picture to the one where the incoming wave is like this, you get things like that. So you have these two interfaces, and then the point when you have basically on a vital horizon, it would look like this, right? This would be in and out, and this would be on the horizon. So we plot this first, what we see is we can then choose what is the frequency, because of course, as I said, a group velocity is frequency dependent, and not all, for some it's a bit more complicated, but you can then choose what kind of wave frequency do I have to send in, such that at some stage the dispersion relation will be tangent. And you can see that in some sense this here, this line 10% will not do it, so you have to send in something higher, and that will be something with 70%, which we send in 70 or 80, and you can then see that's basically here one between this line here, which is those two, you see that basically 70% between that and that line, it becomes tangent. So you know approximately where we expect the horizon to be this way. It's a little bit tricky to get there, but this is how we figured and actually compared it with the experiment, and it works very well. But we need to do some improvements on that. So here, what we did here is actually we took an extremal scenario. So here the flow speeds up much more and so forth, right? And here really what's happening, also that 10% already sees an effective vital horizon there. And then, of course, you can send in, you have a very different behavior. And I will actually show you, we have run this experiment, that everything is adiabatic. What we expect if we go to a more extreme situation, that you not only have conversion for something in to out here, you also have some possibility, if this comes, this is a negative frequency regime. If you map this closer here, if you make this gap smaller, then if there are some non-adiabatic effects, right, then it's more likely that this can happen. So you just make this gap. If you see the negative frequency regime is now bent very much to this side, and this may be possible that you have this non-adiabatic conversion to negative frequency mode, which is a classical Hawking radiation. So this is our experiment. So this is what we send in. And here again, these are the dispersion relations at different positions at the obstacle. And what you see is, so let me see, we send in 70 and 80, right? And that's the first experiment. Okay. So I need 5 more minutes. Is it okay?
There's a lot of discussion, but not more than 5.
Okay. So I have to wrap up. Then let me just show you one experiment. What you see here, these are the troughs and the droughts of the waves we are sending in. So this every line here corresponds to one picture we've taken, and we read of this line, and this basically shows the density variation. So we send waves in. Here, clearly, we send in 5 continuous waves, and then we switch off the wave generator and see what's coming out. We send it in, and there is a white hole horizon. It stops here. You can really see this, right? And then you see what's coming out. And the wave, the velocity of the things is given by, you know, the gradient of this line, the slope of the line. And then, of course, what's coming out has a steeper one, means it propagates slower, because this propagates much faster, as you see as the thing that comes out. So this is how it looks like. And now, just before I left, we worked really, really hard, and we got everything together. So we were just approximately seeing, so where do we expect the horizon? And we were basically comparing this thing, so it really fits around between 40 and 50 centimeters. And you can see it should be between around 38. And it is, okay, so this would be 50, 40, 38. It's approximately working. But as I said, we have to, you know, do a little bit of nice, a more thorough analysis. You have to take into account that this dip, which is there in the black hole horizon. So what we see is actually that it really matches. The white hole horizon is approximately where we expected. Then what you're seeing now, that is basically the Fourier transform of this. And what we plot here, these are the K values, positive and negative, and that's a positive frequency, negative frequency. And what we see is this is what we send in. What is that, right? You send in something with, so that is the first nonlinear effect. So if you send in omega naught and you get something with twice omega naught, it's the first nonlinear effect, which we see here, right? And basically here we have to do, of course, we will analyze it carefully. We see really what is the wavelength you're sending in and what's coming out. And here basically that's the nonlinear effect that we don't want to have. But since we have these diagrams, right, we can cut out the nonlinear effect, go back, and just look at the linear order. We can now, because we have these plots, we can cut out certain part and analyze everything on its own. So Hawking radiation would be some, so the best thing that could happen in this experiment would be that we would see some green, yellow spot here, right here with this frequency, right sitting here, which would be the indication of negative frequency mode at the frequency where we expect it. So that is what we want to do. That is what we're now trying. We assume it is there. We just have to set up the right experiment. So forget about that. So what we can do, we can filter out. So now we filtered out the nonlinear effect. So we just see the linear effect. This will be the only the nonlinear effect. So we see that only nonlinearity is actually generated at the horizon, which should be due to slight breaking of waves and so on. And because, of course, when you hit the white hole horizon, the amplitude piles up. And that's where, of course, the nonlinearity that plays a bigger role. So we have done much, much more, right? But here is a negative zone. Here is an example where I think that's what the people have seen in Europe. I think that here, if you want, there is a negative frequency spot. There are now two reasons why this could happen, right? So here we send continuously motion. The one reason could be that this is just the higher, next higher linear order, which is here, mapped on here, because we are undersampling in time. We have 4,000 pixels of 2,000 pixels in space resolution, but we only have 8 frames a second. We are definitely undersampling in time, and it's really, really difficult to get a better camera. It's very expensive, and we're doing our best to get a better equipment. So this could be, it has to be here. So when we first saw this effect, and we thought, oh my God, this is great. We have a Hawking radiation, but then we started thinking, right? And because it's at the wrong frequency, it cannot be true. And so we think it's either from, you know, bad analysis, we would have to have more pictures per second, or it could be that it's really just a truly nonlinear effect, some breaking of waves, but we're not sure. But this is not what we want. Again, you see here there's also a lot of more nonlinearity, which means that not just the next, the first nonlinearity, also the second one should come in, which would be explaining why it comes down here again. So this would be the fact, the first nonlinear, and then here would be the next one, but it could come back in here. So we think this has nothing to do, and I think this is what the people have seen in Europe. So now, how can we cure this? It's just some details, doesn't matter. So how can we get this green-yellow spot in a negative frequency regime? The day before I left, we had a 4-hour meeting, and we think now the way to do it, we have to drive the flow, you know, for example, this is the big obstacle with the same flow, but there are some issues. We have to make that flow, the how fast you change, so that would be corresponding to the gravitational field on the acoustic horizon, on the white hole horizon, and that is, of course, what defines how non-adiabatic this effect is. So we are now convinced if we drive it up here and you would send in something here which hops part of it, we'll basically just have an adiabatic conversion, and we hope that the other part will jump on this side and will end up as basically as a negative frequency mode. So we hope that we can do this. And now the conclusions. 1 minute. So there are two things, right? Now, first of all, I presented you an experiment. I hope that in some sense you trusted that we kind of know what we're doing. It seems very ambitious, but on the other hand, if in a system like that we would see this effect, I think personally for me, this really has something, would really give me a deep trust in quantum effective field theory in a first spacetime, because there are so many scales in there. The first scale is the height of the fluid. Then I have the capillary water regime. Then I have the fact that there is a molecular structure underneath it, right? Yet, if this still happens and this effect is robust against something so drastic and something so different at small scales, that really is not proving anything, but I think it really gives us a lot of trust in effective field theory and first spacetime. And I think I'll stop here.
Thanks very much. So there was a lot of discussion in the middle, but let's take a couple of quick questions before we go. First, if there's some students here, we always start with the students. Anybody?
I was a student.
You got to be a student. Okay. So,
So you've been talking about white holes, but isn't black cosmic radiation something that comes out of black holes? So
we have the same. So first of all, I did not explain why we have black and white polarized. I mean, it's kind of obvious for me now, right? Because I think it's obvious anyway. If something comes over here, right? Because the flow speeds up here, but then goes slower again. So once you're in this regime, you can propagate in both ways again. So because you speed up, gets up super critical in this regime, and then it slows down again. So this is why we have here a black hole horizon, and here we have a white hole horizon. So at the black hole, here what I said is a conversion. I send an infinitely long wavelength in, and it gets converted into deep water wave. At the black hole horizon, you would have to send in a deep water wave, and out would come an infinitely long wavelength of a shallow water wave, which will be kind of like in quantum sense, this thermal radiation. So why are we doing that? It is actually damn difficult. We have to have a mode which is moving this way. So the only way we could do that using some mild instability, some fan, some surface wind generated surface wave, we thought about it, it's much more difficult, right? So it's just you have to send in a certain mode, right? A certain, it has to be moving this way and so on. And if you want to do it here, it's just more difficult to set up, and no one has done it, but that was one of the things I didn't talk about. That's one of the things we want to do. So this is a simple thing to start with.
So you don't see anything coming out that way? There must be something coming out.
So we don't send in something here. And you know, there's a white horizon. If you send something in here, nothing happening here, because it cannot propagate. But since here, this is a causally disconnected region. It cannot come out.
That's a short wave approximation. If you solve the question exactly, something can happen.
In this regime, as short of the wavelength is, at lower the propagation speed is. So if this one cannot move upstream, this one can't either. If you're in this regime, you're in a capillary water regime, and those ones are die off very quickly. These are just little ripples in a few millimeter wavelengths. They're just dead after a while. They cannot propagate.
Okay. About how quick?
Yeah, well, Nyash asked more or less the same question I wanted to ask, but let me try it in slightly different form, which is, this is meant to be an analog of something that's happening that we think would happen in a quantum field theory in curved space-time, right? Can you say more precisely what is the analogous effect that this corresponds to?
Are the conversion.
What?
The adiabatic conversion.
So in scattering, this is directing a wave at a white hole.
Okay, that's a good point, a good question. So I have two things here, right? I have the adiabatic conversion and the non-adiabatic. I made a very clear statement that the non-adiabatic conversion would be classical equivalence of whole accommodation. I never said what is the classical setting. And you're right, because that is only there because of the particular shape of the dispersion relation, right? This is something which I cannot identify or connect to quantum gravity, because who tells me that in the effective field theory coming from gravity has a dispersion relation like that? So, no, that is only the end of theory. However, I'd like to say that if this wouldn't be there, you couldn't set up the system, because things would just keep on piling up and would spoil them all, because if things pile up, the amplitude grows and grows, and the amplitude relative to the height is too big, it's all nonlinear. Nonlinear means that we need dynamics. So this effect makes the system good, right? This is why we can use it. But nevertheless, we want to see just a small tiny chance of hopping, which is non-adiabatic, which cannot be explained due to that.
So would it be fair to say that this has no direct correspondence in quantum field theory in the black hole background, but if it works out, then you might someday be able to see the black hole kind of evaporation that Nyayas was asking about?
No.
No. Okay, sorry.
No, that's not. So there are two things.
Can I try?
Yeah.
Because I think you went right by it both times. If I understand right, what you mean when you say the classical analog of quantum radiation is you make a non-trivial bodily block transformation happen. That is, you send in positive frequency waves, and you scatter back and mix a positive and negative frequency. And that's full stop, that's the point.
Right.
It's the mixing of positive and negative frequency modes at the price. Non-adiabatically. Because I think we will never detect Hawking radiation out there. I think this is impossible. If you go through the numbers and you convince yourself you can never detect it, then the only chance is this. And all it teaches us is, okay, what if we don't get it? Can we then say Hawking evaporation will not happen in the real world? No, we cannot. But if we do see it here, I'm just making a statement, so this really means a lot, right? I mean, I think all of you are very much concerned that this system is so, so different, really, that this effect shouldn't be there. I'm just saying, if it's there, this gives us a lot of stress. If it's not, if there's a no-show, well, then I think then I'm really, really screwed because I have to write this paper and I don't know how to
That's cool. Any last quick comment question? Okay, well, I think that the natural thing to say is that when you see it, come back and tell us. And Silke is here for until the middle of next week, I think. And she's giving another talk tomorrow, and we look forward to more discussion. Thank you very much.